Good morning. I'd like to welcome you to the Second Court of Appeals this morning. Thank you for being here. Before we begin, I want to introduce the panel to you. To my left is Justice Elizabeth Kerr. To my right is Justice Lee Gabriel, and I'm Chief Justice Bonnie Sutterth. I understand that the attorneys have checked in and are ready, and before we begin the argument, I'll ask the clerk to please read, call the case, please.
Court will now call Simone Barron and Waleed Yameen versus Kasane L. Masoni. And may it please the court, Mr. J.B. Peacock Jr. to argue for the appellant, Mr. Jason Boatwright to argue for the appellant.
You may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. As I've just been introduced, my name is Jack Peacock, and I represent Mr. Waleed Yameen and Simone Barron. I'll try to make the distinction easy between Waleed and Waheed. They're related, of course, and but there is a significant distinction in the course of this lawsuit between the two. Now, you've had the briefs. I know that you've read the briefs and had the opportunity to acquaint yourself with the issues in the law regarding this case. So I want to kind of use my time to put aside, let's say, all the fluff and get right down to the nitty-gritty here. As the court knows, anytime there is a real estate conveyance, it has to be in writing. Every real estate agent knows that. And if there's a modification to a real estate contract, it has to be in writing, and it has to be signed by the parties. And as you know from the facts of this case, a contract was signed between Mr. Waheed Yameen and Mr. Shamisani. I hope I'm saying his last name right. Did I say it right?
You know I can't help you. Because I don't know how to pronounce it either.
Okay. Well, in any event, the parties signed a contract to sell property known as 717 North Main.
Now, of course, the record has different views of what the property actually was that was supposed to be sold. And I'm curious whether your clients are taking the position that the deed that was executed or in April when the transaction closed, was that just totally void, or do you think that the appellee actually bought 717?
The deed's void.
Okay, so what did he what did he get for his $535,000?
What he got was a contract and a right to purchase 717 North Main. Problem is, the deed that has the Exhibit A attached doesn't include 717 North Main. That has a different property description.
So do you think that the jury could not have credited Mr. Newman's testimony that everybody was there and agreed to his writing in the other three property addresses on the day of closing?
Well, the way the question's drafted, certainly they could. Problem is, the addresses that Mr. Newman wrote in, 701, 705, and 709 Main, that property wasn't even owned by Mr. Yameen. What he owned was 701, 705, 709 North Main, And as you know, there's a very significant difference.
But the Exhibit A property, the legal description covered the North Main properties, right?
It did.
Okay.
So what we have is we have a case where the contract of sale says one thing, but the deed says something entirely different. Entirely different. There's no legal connection between that contract of sale and the deed. So that's one of the major distinctions between the cases that the appellee is relying on, and that's Foster and Hodge. That's a very significant issue. Now, one thing that I think is important to note, a deed is only signed by the seller. Now, if for example, if you sign a document, whether it's a deed or anything else, and then a third party puts or adds something to that document that you didn't authorize, is that document going to be binding on you? I don't think so.
What if a fact finder believes that you did authorize it? Is it then binding?
I'm sorry, I didn't...
If the fact finder believes that you did authorize it, does it then become binding?
Not a deed to convey property. It might in other types of contracts, but not a deed to convey property. A deed to convey property has to accurately describe the property, number one, and in our case, the deed that was signed was blank. I think that a seller of property is entitled to rely on the contract that he signed. And if I sign a contract, and I'm making a distinction between the contract and the deed, if I sign a contract to convey property, a certain piece of property, and I sign a blank deed, and that property description is not attached to the deed, there's something wrong in Denmark, and there's something wrong here, and as a matter of law, that case shouldn't even have gone to the jury. The court should have decided that as a matter of law.
Do you think that we should ascribe any legal significance at all to the settlement statement that had 701, 705, and 709 that Waheed did sign?
Okay. Again, he signed a blank document. All the documents at that, what he attended at that closing, everything was blank with the exception of the contract of sale. That he had signed.
So is it his position that when he signed the settlement statement that it was blank too and that the addresses were filled in after the fact on that one as well?
On the front page, yes. That's correct. And I think the evidence bears that out. And that's where that property description is. So, and I might point out that the court submitted questions regarding waiver, regarding estoppel, ratification. Those are totally inapplicable in a situation like this one, where you sign a blank document, but you have a contract that says I'm conveying X, Y, and Z, and the deed says I'm conveying A, B, and C. There's no way that should have even gone to the jury. The court should have decided that as a matter of law. Now, is Mr. Shamizi left without a remedy? No. He has a contract that he signed with Mr. Yameen to buy the property description there, 717 North Main. Now, that's what he contracted to buy, and that's what he's entitled to buy. He's not entitled to all this other property. And the court should have decided that as a matter of law. And so all of the other issues in relating to whether Mr. Wally Yameen filed a deed with fraudulent intent and all of that doesn't even come up That doesn't, that becomes totally irrelevant. And the same with Simone Barron. All of that becomes totally irrelevant because those are properties not applicable to 717 North Main. That's what the contract was, and that's what should have been conveyed. Now, is 717 North Main worth $535,000? I don't know. But as the court knows, whenever you have conveyances of property, the court doesn't look at whether you got a good deal or not. That's not the issue. The issue is what the parties agreed to when they signed a written document to convey real estate.
Well, was there, and I apologize that I haven't read the whole record, but as I understand it, 717 Main, I mean, we know that Mr. Healy was about to foreclose on 01, 05, and 09 on that day.
Yes.
So there was a big hurry to get money to pay off Mr. Healy.
Yes.
From somewhere. But the other one, 717, was also burdened with a lien, wasn't it, by somebody named Cagle?
I don't recall whether it was burdened with a lien and to what extent.
Okay. I'm just wondering how it makes sense.
Well,
when you put it all together that...
Well, it does make sense because Mr. And let me hasten to add, I don't know, I can't recall if there was a lien on 717 North Main or not, and if there was, what the extent of that lien was. It might have been.
But that would have mattered to the appellee.
It could have, depending on the amount of that lien. See, because once the sale is consummated at a title company, that title company pays off that first lien. Like, there could have been enough money there to pay off Healy and whatever lien there was, if there was one, on 717. So it might not have been any problem at all. And if there was a shortage or a shortfall, then, of course, Mr. Waheed Yameen would have had the obligation to pony up whatever was the shortfall out of his own pocket. But that's kind of speculation on my part. I don't know if there was a lien on 717 North Main at the time of that closing or not, or if there was, what the extent of that lien was. It would just sure be speculation on my part. But it could have been a factor, but it's from, in my view, from a purely legal standpoint, it doesn't matter as we stand here today, or as we sit here today. the bottom line is, under Texas law, whenever there's a conveyance of real estate, it has to be in writing. No oral modifications. The case law is absolutely clear whenever there's a conveyance and either there's no property description or there's a property description that is in error, or then you don't have a conveyance.
Well, would it be the same result? I mean, let's say that the deal was for 717, and there's the contract, and it's got the instrument number that we know matches 717 and not the other three for reasons that the parties disagreed on. but let's say that then there's a deed executed, and at that point, the property description for 717 is added. Under your theory that you can't have an oral modification, I mean, why wouldn't that fall into the same posture? Would your clients be saying, we didn't convey 717 either because nothing was attached at the time, if it was added later?
No. I believe Foster and Hodge would be applicable then, because then the seller would have authorized that, okay? The one that signs the deed. And going back to, Shamashani, the buyer, doesn't sign the deed. Only the seller signs the deed. On some occasions, a buyer will need to sign a deed, but ordinarily that never happens. And so if I'm signing a document, it needs to reflect my intent, what my contract of sale says. And if it doesn't, then there's something wrong. And that's what happened here, a property description, and it's undisputed that the title company was all over the place after Mr. Waheed had signed the deed and gone back to Lebanon. The record is clear that the title company is all over the place trying to figure out, well, what was supposed to be sold. One of them said this, another one of them said that. My response is, wait a minute, you have a contract of sale that says 717 North Main. Now, Mr. Newman added some other, but that's inapplicable because 701, 705, and 709 Main was not owned by Mr. Yameen. So that's totally inapplicable. And he didn't sign it. He didn't initial that. Nothing. And Newman admitted on the stand that he should have.
Your time is up.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Chief Justice, may it please the court, good morning. I'm Jason Boatwright for Issam Al-Shmezani, I think. That's the best I can do. I think my job here today is to be candid with you and to answer your questions. You've got 60,000 words of briefing. I'm sorry about that. I'll try to respond to Mr. Peacock's points and tell her unless you all have questions for me, and I'll do my best to answer them. I think that the 701, 705, 709 versus 701, 705, 709 North Main distinction is a red herring. Property description for 701, 705, and 709 North Main was attached by the appellants themselves to instruments that they recorded themselves both before and after the April 2nd, 2012 closing. There's ample testimony by non-parties in this case that the transaction was for 701, 705, and 709 North Main, not 701, 705, and 709 Main. I think the evidence is also clear that the parties, that the appellants thought that they had sold 701, 705, and 709 North Main. They acted like they did. They tried to assign option agreements to themselves for that property. They tried to execute an option agreement for that property. They tried to convey portions, not all of it, but portions of that property to themselves for quite some time, for right after closing and for some time afterwards. I believe I'll just go through the points until y'all have questions.
Actually, I've got a question.
Yes, ma'am.
This is a
please
a footnote to all this in some sense, but I know that Ms. Smith, the title person, is not your client, but you had mentioned in your briefing the sanctions/attorney's fees that were awarded to her. I can't find in the record where we have Ms. Smith's Rule 13 motion for sanctions against Simone Barron, so I'm hoping that somebody can clear up how it is that the trial court awarded Ms. Smith $21,000 in attorney's fees. I mean, tagged her with that money to pay to Ms. Smith.
I'd be happy to look into that after argument,
okay.
Your Honor.
I just didn't know.
Thank you for bringing that up. Right. You asked earlier, Justice Kerr, whether the contract was void. They say it is because because the transaction was for 717. I believe that Ms. Barron's first brief said that that there was no property description with the, at all for the properties that were conveyed. I think the reply brief said that there were that the instrument number was adequate to give at least some indication of what the property was, or what property was being conveyed, and that therefore Reserve Petroleum, Foster v. Lessing were inapplicable. I think that there was not a property description. I think that the parties agreed to add it later. There is ample testimony in the record that's what their intentions were.
Are there cases out there that say that an instrument number and nothing else is sufficient?
No, I've looked. Well, I haven't found those cases. I look for cases that included an instrument number like this, cases where there was an address included but no meets and bounds or lot so and so, and I couldn't find that. The best we can do is look at these cases which we think are the most closely analogous that didn't contain a property description, and that is the case here in this case. That although there was an instrument number that referred to a warranty deed that did not itself refer to 717, Mr. Newman added 701, 705, 709 in the presence of the parties with their agreement, and they also agreed later to add a property description, which was for 701, 705, and 709 North Main. You asked earlier, Justice Kerr, whether fact finder could believe the things that I just said. I think so. I know that you've looked at the record, as all of you have. You said you haven't looked at all of it. I think you might have the honor of doing that soon. I think that you'll be extremely impressed with the patience of the trial court, the meticulous, careful commitment to letting the appellants present their case below, to make sure that the jury got to hear absolutely everything that the jury was authorized to hear, and that having meticulously, carefully, patiently presided over this trial, that the jury heard ample evidence that allowed them to return the verdict that they returned, and I think that the judgment is also meticulous, and that it also should be affirmed. Do you have any other questions for me? Thank you very much.
Your Honor, I represent Ms. Barron. I apologize for being late.
Are you just announcing that, or did you want to
to argue for Ms. Barron whenever it's our turn?
Well, you didn't check in, and we did not a lot for that. Although, if Mr. Boatwright doesn't mind yielding some of his time, he gave us some time back. I'll give you an opportunity to rebut whatever said.
I don't mind, Your Honor. Thank you.
I'll give you 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to address primarily the claims against Ms. Barron, which were the violation of the Fraudulent Lien Filing Act and the sanctions that were awarded against her, as well as the lift stay. I would note that Ms. Smith's counsel didn't file any response to our briefing, and I was also not able to find any evidence that there was a motion for sanctions against Ms. Barron by Ms. Smith or request that could support the relief that was granted against her there. There was against Waheed, and I think that those just got mixed up in the judgment. This wasn't in the record, but when I asked Mr. Hampton about it, he didn't wasn't able to direct me to anything in the record either, so I don't think there is anything in the record on that point. That, I think, should be the easiest decision. With regard to the lift stay motion that was granted in Simone Barron's bankruptcy case and whether, you know, our argument that monetary judgment can't be awarded against her based on that, the case law that I looked at was very specific to the language in the lift stay order, and I didn't find anything particularly analogous to this case. But I would point out that if you read the lift stay order, it says that the lift stay is granted for the purpose of allowing this case to go on, and then it goes on to say that it's lifted for the express purposes of getting possession of the property and title to the property. And when there's the express purposes that the case is allowed to go forward on, I think that's exclusive of other purposes. And it's the first clause allowing this case to move forward was not saying that this case could move forward on any claims that may be brought in this case.
You don't think that the terms inter alia and regarding are broad enough to sort of subsume within them possible damages awards that might be awarded in connection with recovering title to property?
I think that if it was read that way, then the second paragraph would have no meaning. The purpose of the adding a second paragraph to that was to narrow it to possession and title. We cited case law showing, and again, I'm not going to try to argue the facts are the same because they're very different, but the case law is very clear that any actions taken in violation of an automatic stay in bankruptcy court are void ab initio, not voidable later. And so that's our argument, is that it's the monetary judgments against Simone Barron, anything not related to title or possession would be void, and we're asking the court to find that. In regard to the claim that Ms. Barron violated the fraudulent lien statute, we cited a case, Allen versus Martin, where this is in the Dallas Court of Appeals. They found that you have to have specific in proof of intent to cause a financial injury, and if there is such an intent, then that can support a $10,000 statutory sanctions, regardless of whether there's actual damages. But you still have to have evidence of that intent. And in this case, the evidence there was no evidence of an intent to cause any specific injury. The plaintiff said that they were going to go forward solely on, and I would also add, just for the court, the plaintiff's name is pronounced Shmaisani. That's the pronunciation of his name. So Mr. Boatwright got it pretty much correct. There was no evidence of intent to cause a financial injury in this case. Also, the knowledge element is a very high burden. It's actual knowledge, not a should-have-known standard. And I think it's a high burden for a reason, because this is a statute that changes the common law of slander of title. There was no slander of title action brought in this case. And this is a statutory cause of action that only applies in very limited circumstances. Also, we would acknowledge that the case law has lots of examples where deeds or deeds of trust or other instruments were considered fraudulent liens or claims under the statute, but the statute literally only applies when the person filing the document has knowledge that intent that it be treated as a court record or other document of a court. And then it goes on to list types of court under the penal code. In this case, there was no evidence that Ms. Barron intended the deed to the trust that she filed on the assets that she purchased from the bankruptcy. And I see that my time's up.
Thank you. And I assume that you're Mr. Grist.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. I want to make sure we have that on the record. Mr. Boatwright, do you want to respond?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
You have 5 minutes as well.
Thank you. As Justice Kerr pointed out, the lift stay order contained the words inter alia. Ms. Barron's original brief didn't address that. The words inter alia mean, among other things, there are many cases that have held that that's expanding rather than contracting. It literally means, in Latin and in English, it's a common term, which means this, and then other things that aren't named.
Well, so what about Mr. Grist's argument that the second paragraph would be superfluous if we didn't read it as limiting the issues to simply possession and title?
Well, I think that if you read the second paragraph to do that, then the words inter alia would be superfluous. In other words, the words inter alia, I think, have to mean this and then other things. If you read the second paragraph to mean only this rather than other things, then you're reading out the term inter alia. Let's see. I'll go to Holland. Justice Lange's opinion in Holland addressed a situation where the party was aware that the instrument was fraudulent. The court found that there was no evidence of intent to cause injury. This court's opinion in Taylor Electric Services, I think, is the more analogous case here. This court reviewed the evidence in that case and found evidence of the knowledge of the importance of the instrument, and the transaction went to intention to cause injury. I believe Taylor Electric Services also found that knowledge of likely effect of the instrument goes to evidence of intent, and the evidence of the party's knowledge of the importance and knowledge of the effect satisfied, I think I'm quoting the case, I apologize if this is just a paraphrase, but knowledge of the importance and knowledge of the effect satisfied the intent prong of a fraudulent lien claim. Do you have any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Peacock?
Thank you, Your Honor. I assume I have 5 minutes?
Yes.
Okay.
You have your 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, in response to counsel's argument about whether there's fraudulent intent or not, number one, there's absolutely, the record is devoid of any evidence of fraudulent intent. And secondly, the record is devoid of any damages. Even if there was fraudulent intent, they have to prove damages. There's no evidence of any damages. So, and as the court knows, when there's no damages, there's no case, unless there's statutory damages or some such thing as that, but there's no evidence of that. So,
well, I remember seeing references to Mr. Shmaisani saying that his title was clouded. Was there anything more specific than that?
There wasn't. And as the court knows, and probably have seen it many, many times, where a plaintiff or a counter plaintiff alleges claims but then has no damages or doesn't prove any damages, then that theory of recovery goes away. So there's no basis for it. Now, one question that I want to deal with before my time's up came up when Mr. Boatwright was here, and that was whether an instrument number is sufficient in a contract. And I can tell you that it is. And in this particular contract, it says not only the instrument number of the document, but it gives the date of the document. So, and let me tell you why that instrument number is sufficient. Because very often, you'll see this, if you look at deed records, which I'm sure you don't have time to look at, but if you did, you would see thousands upon thousands of references of to other deeds or deeds of trust that say volume 10, page 1,000 of the Deed of Trust Records of Tarrant County, Texas. Or you would see volume whatever it is, page whatever it is, of the deed records. Of an instrument number is the same thing. Every document, every deed, or any instrument filed of record is going to have an instrument number. So you can easily refer to it. The point is, and the law is, if you can find the document that has a description from the document that's at issue, then that's sufficient. So as a matter of law, that's sufficient. Now, he also mentioned that there were later documents that had the subsequent property description that was located by Sharon Smith. I don't know, it probably was about 11 days after the closing. All of those documents, if you look at those documents, you'll see they do have the lots and blocks that were referred to in that that Sharon Smith attached to the deed. However, all of those documents were not documents that Mr. Waheed had anything to do with. He was in Lebanon. So all of this about, well, these other documents would have supported the fact that he agreed with this property description has no basis. Absolutely zero basis. So as a matter of law, the court, and I appreciate the fact that the judge was patient. I understand that. But this case should have been decided as a matter of law at the front end. The court should have decided as a matter of law the deed is insufficient as a matter of law. It doesn't coincide with the contract at all.
Your time is up.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Gentlemen, we appreciate your argument here today. Your case has been submitted, and you are now free to go about your business if you'd like, or you can stay and listen to our next case. And I will caution you, Mr. Grist, not to be late for court again. Thank you.